Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. ArchiCAD is the official BIM software of the Entree Architect community. ArchiCAD BIM software enables design, collaboration, visualization, and project delivery no matter the project size or complexity. With flexible licensing options and a dedicated support team to guide us along the way, ArchiCAD is an ideal choice for firms and projects of any size. I encourage you to reach out and talk to the folks at Graphisoft by visiting our own dedicated webpage at graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect. There's even an exclusive special offer waiting for our Entree Architect community. Go now to graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect and see how Graphisoft is positioned to help make your architecture firm a success. That's graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Rick Lindley, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hey, Mark. Glad to be here. I'm excited to spend some time talking about the design of practice.
Yeah, me too. You and I have connected several times offline. You're a member of the Academy. You recently did an expert training session for us inside the Academy.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I appreciate the work that you did to share it with us. So thank you.
Great.
Let me introduce you. Rick Lindley leads Strong Practice Strategy, a business consultancy focused on helping leaders of evolving and emerging design firms to strengthen their practice. His work is informed by over 30 years of practice experience, culminating in his role as principal and chief operating officer of a 200-person, multidisciplinary, multi-location design firm. Rick taught professional practice at a master's level for 10 years. He's a frequent speaker at professional education sessions. And as I had mentioned, he actually has worked with our community several times. And he's also recently published his first book, Scoreboard Your Practice, 7 Numbers to Understand Your Design Firm's Financials. So he's writing for us. He's helping us. He's helping us build our firms and trying to make it in a way that architects can understand. So, Rick, it's great to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me, Mark.
Let's start with you. Let's start with your origin story. Go back as far as you want to go back. When did you discover your passion to do, and who or what inspired you to get started?
Okay, well, I knew you were going to ask me this question. So I've been a student of your podcast. So I don't have any history of building industry or architecture in my family other than hammering nails into a wooden plank in my grandfather's basement. That was probably as much family history and architecture. So I'm a novice from a family standpoint. But I knew you were going to ask me this, so I kind of divided my professional story up into kind of five chapters.
Great.
So chapter one started out with I did well in drafting in those days and carpentry in high school. And I came, I naively thought that, well, maybe I should be an architect. And I thought that was all about drawing buildings and building. And so I left home and I went off to school. And while I was pursuing my degree, I worked in three or four design firms, small firms, medium firms, large firms. So I got a good sense of kind of what that life was like. And so I was basically, this first chapter was kind of building my professional skills and all the other startup activities in life, like getting married and having kids and all that kind of stuff. And then chapter two is really I joined the firm that I actually ended up retiring from. They were about 50 people at that time. So, you know, I guess that's maybe considered a large practice. I learned my craft, pencil on vellum and ink on Mylar and pin bar. I don't know if any of your your listeners ever did pin bar drafting.
I did not do pin bar, but that was just before me.
Okay. And then I remember the first computer was a 286 IBM computer that we had one of them in an office of 50
yes.
people,
yep.
and you had to book time on it. And then, you know, learning Lotus and WordPerfect. And then we purchased, the firm purchased a GDS, Tektronix hardware GDS graphic design system that was used by McDonnell Douglas. That was our first CAD system. And then all the other stuff that goes along with, you know, understanding your skills in practice, you know, all the software we use today. And so I started focusing on leading projects. You know, obviously I was a pair of hands to start with, but evolved into, I was very interested in the project leadership side of practice. So that involved being a project architect, project manager. And so I kind of spent about 10 years learning that skill set, how to lead a project, understanding project financials and metrics, and that took 10 years. So I don't know if that's because I'm a slow learner or I had poor mentors or whatever, but then I went on to what I call chapter three, which was I read a book called Success Strategies for Design Professionals by the Cox Group, the Eastern Seaboard of the U.S. And that kind of turned me on to, I realized the leverage for making for better projects was to focus on the management of the practice. So that's what I did. I saw that that's where the leverage was. And so I kind of pushed myself into an associate position in the firm and then a principal position, and ended my career as chief operating officer of the firm. I was kind of in that role for about 10 years as well. And so that process allowed me to understand the firm, the practice financials, not just the project financials, and what leading a practice was all about. And we made a conscious decision in that chapter of my life as a firm to move ourselves from being a generalist practice of 50 or 60 or so people at that point to being a more of a specialist practice. So that's what we did. That's where we started to go. And so chapter four was, while I was in the role of chief operating officer, I was part of the executive team that was tasked with growing the practice. And we ended up at, when I retired, 200 people. And we did that organically, and we did it through mergers and acquisitions. So that was, you know, that's an interesting part of practice, is learning all that stuff.
Yeah.
And while all this is going on, I'm in my role as chief operating officer, I'm looking for what I call the silver bullet to, you know, what's the one thing, maybe relates back to your, yeah, what's the formula? So I started looking for the formula. I looked at ISO, I looked at TQM, I looked at Project Management Institute, I looked at LEED, I looked at Lean. A lot of that stuff, and we kind of, you know, my team, we went through that stuff, and some of it was great. Some of it we kind of forgot and moved on from. And so then this chapter of my professional career, we actually got our practice up to about 200 people in multiple locations in the States and Canada. And then we sold our practice at that time, they were about 6,000 people. Today, there were over 50,000 people. And the successor firm continues to fall under that umbrella. So I retired when I was 56. I'm 65 now, so that's 9 years ago. And I never did find the silver bullet. I remember my my parting words was, "I looked hard, guys, but I just never found it." And so that brings me to the chapter that I'm currently in my professional life was still kind of I'm a grinder, so I'm kind of a sucker for punishment. So I just kept looking for the silver bullet, and part of my search involved what I found kind of a parallel universe in terms of the practice, and that is the marketing and agency world, advertising agencies.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's a kind of a parallel universe because they're a bunch of creative firms, creative people in creative firms. It's more or less a cottage industry like we are. Our profession is, you know, a whole bunch of small firms and a few really big firms. And that's the way they are. They have a few really big advertising agencies, but a whole bunch of small ones. And it's all business to business. It's not a retail thing. And the problems that trying to solve are complex, just like our problems. And so the thing I found doing that research is that that world is much better than I think our world is at things like how to price work, how to pitch work, how to build confidence in your teams. And you've had some of those folks on your as part of your group, Blair Enns,
right?
Others are David Baker, Tim Williams, Jonathan Stark, I know has been on your program. So those are really interesting people for me. I've been following them. Great podcast called The Two Bobs.
When you listen to The Two Bobs podcast, if you don't realize that they're talking about advertising agency, you would think they're talking about architects.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So it's a great place if you want to go deep into this stuff. That's a great place to go.
Yes,
and that's what I've been doing. So I realized that we've had a kind of a relentless focus within the practice of architecture on the practice of design, like getting better at our craft. And I think that that's forced us. We've kind of got blinders on in terms of just focusing on the practice of design. We're generalists when we should have more expertise. We focus on time instead of results. We focus on project metrics instead of practice metrics. Our pricing approach is cost-based instead of value-based pricing. Things that you have been discussed, that you've been discussing with lots of people in your group, and so then I kind of came, the light bulb kind of came on, and I realized I know what the silver bullet is now. It's not the practice of design; it's the design of practice, and that is where the leverage is for our profession, I think, and other professions have figured that out too.
Yeah.
But I think we're a little late to the game here. So I started a consultancy because I wanted to bring that perspective to the people I knew in my community and beyond. So I've been helping, what I've been doing in my consulting practice is helping firms design their practices. So I think that's really the only way that our profession is going to be able to move forward. So that's been my focus. Part of this thing has been codifying a roadmap, which is what I talked about in the October session, the expert session, a roadmap for practice. So, you know, we're all designers, kind of ironic, but we're designers, and yet I don't think we're doing a very good job designing our practices. So that's what that roadmap is about. And then I went on as part of that roadmap is getting a better understanding of your financials. And so I wrote the book, Scoreboard Your Practice. That's kind of where I've gotten to in my professional career. I don't know what's next, but that's where I am right now.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad that you're in this point of your life doing the things that you're doing, because our profession needs you. It needs the information that you are providing. The expert training session was fantastic. It's available as in the membership. If anybody's in the membership, you can go search the expert training sessions, and Rick's session is in there. You talked about the difference between practice of design, which is what most architects focus on, and the design of practice. Can you dive into that a little bit, and let's have a chat about what that means and how that could help our listeners?
I'd love to. Yeah. I think that difference is just a turn of phrase, but I think the difference is critical. I think it's the root of a lot of our struggles as a profession. We tend to think that getting better at our craft and increasing our skills will lead to a better business. Well, you've had Michael Gerber on your program, or he's Context and Clarity.
Yeah, Context and Clarity Live. Yeah. He's on YouTube, on our channel.
Yeah, right. And he talks about the fact that just because you know what you're doing from a craft standpoint, from a professional standpoint, doesn't mean you know how to run a business.
Right.
And so he talks about the entrepreneurial myth, the e-myth. And I think we're architects kind of, so I'm not a very good business person. So what, I'm willing to sacrifice that for, we're kind of known for sacrificing everything for our craft.
Yes.
Not professionals, we're into it, but I don't think we sacrifice our compensation. We sacrifice our long-term sustainability personally from our health standpoint, and also in terms of our practices. The sustainability of our practices. I think, it's a noble pursuit. And I think we architects think that good enough is never good enough. We have to get better and better and better. And, that's a great sentiment, and it's noble, but I think we already are good enough. And I think we already are impactful. But I think we can continue to do good work and have an impact without having to sacrifice so much. So to make that happen, I think we have to shift our focus to the design of our practice, and we need to find ways to communicate our value, the value of our work. We need to get better at that, and we need to figure out how to get more broadly recognized for what we do.
Yeah, and you do that as consultant. You do that through the authorship of your book. At the expert training session, you talked about that roadmap, the model that you. When you're talking about the design of your practice, can we dive into that a little bit and share a little bit about what that roadmap looks like and how that model works?
Yeah, sure. In the October session, in simple terms, the roadmap is really simple. It's kind of ridiculously simple. It starts with, do you know what your goals are for your practice? And those goals have to be based on your current reality. So step one, do you know your goals? Do you know where you're starting from? And then you've got to position your firm, and you've got two constituencies that you're positioning for. You're positioning for clients, and you're positioning for staff. Big issue these days.
When you say positioning, what does that mean?
Okay. So positioning means establishing your where you have expertise to offer in the marketplace. Okay. And making some choices. The generalist mindset is I can do anything for anybody, anytime. That's a crappy position to be in, because the marketplace isn't looking for generalists anymore. The marketplace is looking for specialists. It's not that we should become specialists just to be specializing. The world doesn't want us to be generalists anymore. That used to be the case, but it's not the case anymore. So we've got to position ourselves. And so that's how we attract clients to ourselves. That's how we attract staff to come to our practices. And then once you've established your position in the marketplace, you've got to figure out how to, every firm has an operating system, and the operating system has to complement the positioning. So if you're a generalist practice, and there are lots, in general, they struggle, but
there are some that are very successful, but most struggle because of the model.
Yeah, and I would I'll we can offline, we can have an argument. You can name those what you think are generalist practices.
Yeah, they're most likely specialists.
I'll show you how they aren't. Yeah.
I'm trying to be devil's advocate here.
That's
I'm
okay.
I'm all on your side, Rick. You know that. The listeners know that too.
Okay. So this thing I call alignment, aligning your operating system with your positioning. And so generalists have a certain operating system, tends to be all over the place. Specialists
Out of necessity, it's all over the place because they're generalists. They're serving all these different markets.
Jack of all trades, master of none. Yeah. So positioning properly and then getting your operating system, your firm's operating system, to line up with your positioning. So that's the three step. That's the roadmap in real simple terms. But I think the key is knowing where you're starting from, because if I as a teenager wanted to be a NBA player, my current reality is I'm 5'7". That is not going to happen. So I need to adjust my goals to suit my current reality, right? And some firms have certain DNA. I call it their DNA. And that DNA may be appropriate for some sorts of specialization and positioning, but it may not be appropriate for others. So you gotta understand where you're starting from. So that's very important. And then once you've established your goals, the thing about designing a practice that's different than designing a project is that a project has a start and a finish. Your practice doesn't. Well, maybe it has a start and a finish, but what you're working on as you're designing is it's an iterative process, right? You're positioning and then you're aligning your operating system. Then the world changes and you have to reposition and then reset your operating system. So it's always positioning and aligning. And while you're doing that, you're keeping score, scoreboard. You're keeping score of your practice. And you're also looking at, am I the right size that I need to be based on my goals and, what I'm trying to do in the practice, in my practice. So, my job as chief operating officer of our firm was the CEO and the board would set the direction, would establish the position that the firm wanted to be in the marketplace. And then my job as CEO with my team was to align the operating system of the firm with the positioning. So that would be things like, how do we market? How do we price? How do we deliver our projects? That, depending on your position, all those things are different. Those aspects of an operating system are all different for different firms with different specialization. And yet I think we get caught up in this best practice mindset where HOK's best practice is the same as Kahn, Peterson, Fox. They may be, but they may not be, depending on what their positioning is in the marketplace. So that's the roadmap is goals, positioning, alignment.
Right, and the operation system is what you just said. It's all of the systems that you use to operate your firm, right? So your marketing system, your sales, production system, all the pieces that make your firm work together are your operating, for clarification.
Yeah, and the biggest one is your people. How do you compensate? How do you hire? How do you retain? How do you engage? In our world, people is your biggest expense in any design firm. People is your biggest expense, whether you're a solo practitioner or a 100-person firm. So people is a big component of that operating system. And the way people are treated in different kinds of firms is usually, if it's done right, is a function of the way they position themselves in the marketplace for both staff and clients.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode is brought to you by RCAT.com. We all have that one story, that one project that had such a unique situation that it required a solution that you had rarely considered before. We share these stories in private professional circles with our friends and our colleagues, but there has never been a collection of these stories of conflict and triumph all in one place. Until now. Detailed is a podcast series that features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who share their insights and expertise as they highlight some of the most complex, interesting, and oddball building conditions that they have ever encountered, and the ingenuity it took to solve them. Join host Charisse Lakeside, aka CSI Kraken, a senior specifications writer at RDH Building Science, as she uncovers lessons learned to help you navigate similar challenges that may arise in your next project. Detailed, an original podcast by ArtCat. Listen and subscribe right now at rcat.com/podcast. That's rcat.com/podcast. ArcaT.com/podcast. Detailed. Every building has a story. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. You also mentioned earlier that in order to do all of this, you need to keep track. And you talked about a scoreboard, which I love. I love, you know, sort of simplifying it into here's how it's done and here's how you keep track of it. You wrote the book called Scoreboard Your Practice, 7 Numbers to Understand Your Design Firm's Financials. So you're focused on financials with this scoreboard. Can you talk a little bit about this scoreboard and how it works and how our listeners might be able to apply it to what they do?
Sure. Start with how we do things now, which is poorly. I think as a profession, we understand our project financials, I think, pretty well. Although lots of discussion on Entree Architect about, well, what kind of software should I be using to track my projects? And you know, some people do it with Excel spreadsheets, and some people don't do it at all. And some firms do it with, Monograph or whatever. So we keep track of our hours.
When you talk about the project finance, are you talking just...
Okay, so I'm talking about the efficiency, how well is a project doing. We often use terms like multipliers and utilization rates and direct labor versus indirect labor and all these terms that a lot of us don't really care much about because we're focused on our craft. But project managers do care about those numbers. And so those are measuring individual projects,
right,
separate from the firm overall. So the scoreboard is a way to measure the overall practice, not projects. So okay. I think, you know, our mindset is, well, what do you mean? Our practice is our projects. So if we add up project A, project B, project C, right, that will equal our practice. But I think that's the wrong approach. That's kind of a bottom up approach. Add up all our projects and there's our practice. I think we should think of it in terms of what are our goals for our practice, design the financials for the practice, and then slot the projects into that in service of that goal for the overall firm.
Right. Okay. And another reason to have a specialty and position yourself within the market, because that makes that process easier.
A lot easier. That's very important. So I think we need this kind of top-down approach, which is what the scoreboard,
yep,
takes, a top-down approach. And it's kind of a conceptual approach. I'm not an accountant. I don't have any, I'm not a CPA. I don't have that kind of training. I didn't want to learn that stuff. But as a chief operating officer, I got exposed to the firm's financials. And it was always hard to talk to my partners and staff about how the firm was doing. They were all focused on projects. So the book is kind of a conceptual top-down approach. It's about how do we measure the firm? Where do we find that information? How do you keep it straight in your head? Because that stuff is hard for architects to keep straight in their heads. It's hard to communicate to your bankers, your other shareholders. In fact, one of my ASG colleagues mentioned that his spouse is his banker. So the scoreboard helps to bridge that gap between people who understand financials and people who don't, like us for the most part. So the idea is to try and tackle the problem that the architects are often encouraged by both their profession and their accountants to understand their financials from an accounting perspective. But I don't think that works. I I've never seen it work. And primarily it's because we don't want to be bookkeepers and accountants. We want to understand only enough of this stuff to run our practices and to run them well. But really, we don't need to understand a lot more. So it needs to be simple. It needs to be, for me, I felt it needed to be graphic. And it needs to be visible, something that you could post up on the wall. And so that whoever you wanted to see it, some firms are more open than others, but whoever you want to see it can understand it at a glance, where you're at as a practice. And so that's what this scoreboard does. It's actually modeled on a call out that you'd find on any drawing, circle with a line through it. And it's modeled on that call out. We use those call outs to navigate our way around drawing sets. And I think the scoreboard can be used to navigate our way around our practices financials. So there are seven numbers.
So how does that work? What are the seven numbers?
Okay. So there's seven numbers and one ratio, which is a ratio of two of the numbers. So the first one is how many full-time equivalents do you have in your practice? That's you can go around if you're in a room these days or on a Zoom call. you can look around, count heads, figure out how many of them are full-time, how many of them are part-time, do a quick calculation, and you got full-time equivalent. So if you're solo practice, that's easy. One. If you've got four or five people and a couple are part-time, you might have a 4.3 FTE count. So you need that number, one. Then you need to know what your net fee is for your practice. And really simply, net fee is all the money that comes in, which is gross income. And just a quick aside here.
Yep.
The terminology is great for accountants, but doesn't work for us. There's way too many terms out there. Cost of goods sold, EBITDA, net revenue, net fee, net income. I mean, it's all Greek to us. So I've tried to stick to really simple terminology. So net fee is take your gross fee, subtract out your subconsultants like structural, mechanical, electrical, if you happen to be paying them, subtract out any reimbursables that are going to be the client's going to pay for, subtract those out, and that's your net fee. Real simple. Then you have three parts of that net fee. Part one is your payroll. And that in a well-run firm, that usually is about half of your net fee, 50% of your. And then you have your operating expenses, which is all, the lights, janitors, services, whatever. It's a very long list. And if you look at a profit and loss statement, a P&L statement, it makes up most of your P&L statement. So, but it's really the one number that's important. You can dig into when you need to. And then the third number, and by the way, operating expenses in a well-run firm should be about one quarter of your net fee, 25%. Okay. And then the last number that makes up, I call it the pie, the net fee pie, is operating profit. And in a well-run firm, that should be 20 to 25% of your net fee, which is operating profit. That's not all in my pocket profit, but it's what you get to work with as a owner of or leader of a practice. So that's the three parts of the net fee pie, and then a couple of other things. You've got to know what your pipeline is. I call that the crystal ball. What kind of work is coming up on your for your practice. So there are ways to project to estimate your pipeline. Pipeline is made up of two parts. Part one is the work you already have, but you have a contract for it, but you haven't finished the work. So that's a chunk of work that might last for the rest of the year, or it might have 5 years worth of work that's under contract. The other part of backlog The other part of the pipeline is prospects. And that's the stuff that you haven't got a contract for, but you think you have a pretty good chance of getting it. So in the book, I share a really simple approach to figuring out what your prospects are going to be mathematically by factoring fees, et cetera. And so those are the seven, and one more number is How much cash do you have on hand? How much cash do you have if maybe a pandemic happens, or one of your clients says, "Oh, interest rates are too high. I have to bail on this project." So do you have some cash to tide yourself over for a couple or 3 months? And then the one ratio that is kind of, if you only know one number in your practice, it should be this ratio of net fee per full-time equivalent. So just as an example, a struggling practice, the way I would define a struggling practice, does less than $120,000 per full-time equivalent of net fee. And when I say full-time equivalent, that's everybody. That's administrative people, principals, and staff. That's everybody. And that's every head on the Zoom call or around the room. So struggling firms, less than 120,000. Strong firms, 120 to 170,000 net fee per FTE. I call them super firms, is 170 and up of net fee per FTE. So, if you're doing $200,000 of net fee per FTE, so if you're a three-person firm and you're doing $600,000 in net fee, then that's 200,000 per head, right? And that's a very good position to be in within our industry. When you look at benchmarks like Dell Tech and others, I call that a super firm.
Yeah.
So those numbers will tell you a lot about your practice. Just keeping those seven numbers top of mind, this graphic diagram that I've created helps to do that. It's kind of a back of the napkin kind of thing that you can do. You don't need software. All you need is a pencil and a napkin, a pen and a napkin, to keep track of your numbers. And as I said, those numbers will tell you a lot about, whether your clients are happy or not. Those numbers will tell you whether your clients are happy, because if you're not getting paid, you don't have cash on hand. And so it's probably because something's wrong in that area. Your payroll number will tell you how efficiently you're executing your work. And generalists tend to execute it less efficiently because they're always learning a new thing, whereas the experts already know it, and so they can execute that work quicker, and that so their payroll number doesn't have to be as extravagant. All those numbers, they'll tell you the story of your practice can be captured with those seven numbers and that one ratio.
Yeah, which simplifies it so much. I mean, you don't have to know all the numbers and the details behind all of that if you know those seven numbers.
Right.
It makes everything easier to understand. It also allows you to spot trends, right? So look at those numbers. Absolutely. On a regular basis, and things continue moving in a positive way. You say, oh, we're doing the right thing. Just keep doing what we're doing. Keep growing, doing the things. But if you see a trend happen somewhere in one of those numbers, you know something's wrong. You can dig in deeper to find out what it is and how to fix it before the end of the month or before the end of the year, which is often how those problems reveal themselves.
Or before the cash runs out. The cash on hand runs out.
Yeah. So you had said earlier, Rick, that your firm, when you joined that firm, you were about 50 people and you grew it to 200 by the time that retired from that firm. How important is growth? And remember that we're talking primarily to small firms and a lot of sole practitioners. How important is firm size and how important is the concept of growth? Because there's a lot of architects out there that just, I don't really want to grow. I want to do what I'm doing forever.
Well, we've all heard the grow or die maxim that's out there. And I think that's nonsense. I think that that's the way we've been conditioned to think, because we're all exposed to the world of business. For most of us, the exposure we get is big publicly traded companies who aspire to grow. They talk about growth in terms of size. Now, when we go to a social event, starting to do that more, and somebody says, "Hey, what do you do?" And I'm an architect. Oh, how big's your firm? Well, I have 12 people. Nobody ever asks you what's your net fee for your firm, because probably you wouldn't tell them. And two, we measure by how many people we have, which is kind of dumb. Because you could be a big firm struggling because you're not having much net fee per FTE. So growth doesn't really, we can fall into a trap called the growth trap, where we take on new work, then we have to take on more people, which is great. And so because we're a really compassionate bunch, we tend to be, I think, we try to keep staff. Once we have them, we've invested in them. We try to keep those people. And so then we need to go get more work when our projects finish. Then we start to take work that we shouldn't be taking because we're desperate not to lay people off. And so that increases our risk. It lowers our profitability. Our cash flow suffers. And so we get into this vicious cycle. Mostly because we're just not ready to deal with our capacity issue quick enough. Whenever you ask somebody, when should you have done, reduce the size of your workforce? The answer is always a lot before I did, way before I did. So I think that's why, if your practice is struggling, why do you think that taking on more work, getting bigger, taking on more risk, taking on more liability, why does that make you stronger? It doesn't. Yeah, I think we should be focusing on strength, not size. And then if you want to grow, growth is fine. There's nothing wrong with growth as long as it's in support of your goals for your firm. If you want to stay a solo practitioner, nothing wrong with that. I think though, having said that, I think you have to accept some of the limitations of solo practice, right? I did a little research. I pulled off the AIA website, from the Small Firm Exchange. I pulled they do a salary survey, and I pulled from there that solo practitioners get paid about 20% less than staff architects on average. And so, I think what that's saying is one thing I don't understand about solo practitioners, maybe Mark, you might know this, but I think a lot of them are kind of transitional. I'm a solo practitioner, but I'm in transition from partial retirement to full retirement. And I think some solo practitioners are kind of starting a practice and they're just kind of figuring out, seeing if they can do it. They may be transitioning to retirement. They may be, I think there's a lot of transitional stuff there. And I think that might drag the average compensation down for solo practitioners. But I think the strong ones are figuring out how to leverage their expertise, get higher contractors, hire, outsource some of their product and get some of their execution stuff so that the stuff they're not good at or overpaid for gets done by somebody so they have more leverage in their practice. I think those are the successful solo practitioners.
Yeah. Yeah. And for all of those reasons are some of the reasons why solo practitioners are solo practitioners. Some of them are transition. But there's a very large percentage of solo practitioners who want to stay solo practitioners, that they've built the model around being a solo practitioner. Many of them are in order to live a specific lifestyle that they've chosen. It gives them the ultimate freedom and flexibility to control their life, and do the things they want to do and work when they want to work and work when they don't want to work. And ultimately make as much money as that model will allow by growing in other ways, like you had mentioned, by hiring contractors. But there are lots of limitations, right? There is a ceiling. At some point, if you want to grow financially to beyond that ceiling, you're going to have to, in terms of staff, because you need more project people to help you.
Yeah, I think the frustrating thing for solo practitioners is that, you work hard every day. You may or may not be able to figure out how to take some vacation time or some sabbatical time. That's you're looking for flexibility. A lot of folks who are solo practitioners, and so it makes it tough to function in that world. But again, it goes back to what are your goals? How are you positioned in the marketplace? What's your operating system? Because a solo practitioner has an operating system. They may have five contractors that they work with, drafts people.
Yeah, or 1099.
From, yeah, 1099 from anywhere in the world, not just in the States. But so I think the successful ones are more like orchestra leaders they're orchestrating a practice as opposed to just trying to do everything, because you just, these days, buildings are too complicated. You can't do everything. You just can't do it at a high enough level to kind of make a decent living, so that you don't have to sacrifice so much, you know? So I think the successful ones have figured that out. And they've designed their practice.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Edward Shannon wrote a book about it. Just plug that. It's I think it's Solo Practitioner Architect or Sole Practitioner Architect. It's you know, anywhere books are sold. He's a solo practitioner, and he wrote a book about how you can be a successful sole practitioner, and talks about the limitations like that. Mm-hmm. But he's very much an advocate of that model, supporter of that model, and acknowledges that for him it's a lifestyle decision, right? That he right. wants to live his life in a very specific way and have total control over it. And he does. So, yeah. Very interesting, Rick. I love your model. I love the simplicity that you bring to complicated subjects. So I appreciate you for doing that. Before we wrap things up, I would like you to answer that question that everybody answers at the end of the show. What is one thing a small firm architect can do today to build a better business?
Well, I knew this question was coming. So I must have listened to 50 or 60 podcasts. And I must confess, I just skipped to the end on a lot of them to hear answers to these questions. And I think most of the answers, not all, but most of the answers have been about the practice of design, how to be better practitioner. And I hope that maybe there'll be some uptake on this notion of the design of practice going forward, and that we spend more time designing our practices. So, you know, what's the one thing you can do today to build a better business for tomorrow, meaning pretty soon, not like a
right.
year away, but
yeah,
but
tomorrow.
Soon. So yeah, tomorrow. So, so to me, the day after tomorrow, the answer is design your practice. But I don't think you can't do that in a day. So if you're going to do one thing today, is go dig into your financials, go figure out where you are financially. And again, that's kind of establishing your current reality as a practice, because if you don't understand your numbers, your financial numbers, you don't understand your business. You may understand your practice, but you won't understand your business. So you got to dig into those numbers. And I think, you know, grab your bookkeeper today, and go sit down and say, you know, I heard this guy today talking about net fee and FTEs, and what are those numbers in my financial statement? Show me where they are here, because I want to understand this. And I think you could do that today. I truly understand that I think a lot of practitioners don't understand their financials, but even if you did, you still need to keep an eye on those as you reposition and realign your practice, realign your operating positioning. So dig into your financials, understand your financials. That would be my message.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be great if every Monday morning, on your desk are those seven numbers?
They could be there. You just tell your yeah. bookkeeper they got to put them there.
Right.
That's all you
right.
got to
do.
And
every Monday you look at them, you're like, okay, there they are.
Yeah.
They look good. Let's move on. Or
yeah.
that one doesn't look good. Why? Why does that
exactly.
not look good? What do I need? Thank you, Rick. Very, very interesting. His name is Rick Lindley. Strong Practice Strategies is the name of the firm. You can go to the website strongpracticestrategies.com and you can learn all about Rick. You can connect with him and say hi and ask him for his advice and all the things that you may be thinking about right now. The book is also there. You can learn about the book, Scoreboard Your Practice, Seven Numbers to Understand Your Design Firm's Financials. You can find that everywhere books are sold. I highly recommend it. I have read it. It is a good book. You should go read it too. It simplifies this complicated stuff for us architects. Rick, thank you. Thank you for the work that you're doing, that you dedicated your life to doing this, to share your knowledge with the rest of the profession, so we can be better architects, so we can learn what we need to learn, so we can keep doing the things that we love doing. Our profession needs more people like you. And so I appreciate you for the work that you do, the book that you wrote, and for coming by here and saying hi at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it. It's been great.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, share a link with a friend. That's how Entree Architect has grown, to serve thousands of architects just like you. Please share a rating, write a review, share a link to this episode with a friend. I'd appreciate it. Links to all our sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode, found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. It's the network dedicated to architects, engineers, and construction pros. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at Gable Media at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. Go check it out. We have, I think, 13 podcasts over there now. gablemedia.com. And before we wrap up, a special thank you to our partners at Graphisoft for helping our community of architects make the transition to BIM with ArchiCAD software. Go now to graphisoft.com/us/entrearchitect and see how Graphisoft is positioning to help make your architecture firm a success. Visit graphisoft.com/us/entrearchitect to learn more. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage. Love, learn, and go share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.